Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte, Washington. Today is Thursday, May 9, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan doctors and two-month-old nationwide strike.
I think the issues have been highlighted, and I think going forward, there will be efforts to avoid large industrial action in future.
Chad's opposition, the Transformers Party, says its candidate and Prime Minister's successor Masera has been threatened with violence. Israel deposed Malawian farm workers for a breach of contract. Africa aims to forge a path for secure data flows across borders. A specialty surgery hospital opens in Ghana. Amnesty International accuses Somalia's military of killing 23 civilians during drone strikes on March 18.
What it just underscores, in my opinion, is the laxity with which these militaries operate in the country such that civilian lives are not valued at all.
And from immigration to citizenship, when is an immigrant allowed to vote in a U.S. election? Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's nearly two-month-old doctor's strike ended Wednesday after the doctors signed a back-to-work agreement. They have been on strike for better pay and improved working conditions. President William Ruto appealed to the doctors to reconsider their demand for pay raises because the government could not spend money that it does not have. However, a court gave both sides 48 hours to finalize a back-to-work agreement, or the court would step in and impose a solution. Dr. Simon Chigundu is president of the Kenya Medical Association. He tells me the strike was worth it because it brought the government and doctors to address the doctors' concerns.
2 days ago, both parties presented to the court. The court and the doctor's advocate asked the judge to give them 48 hours instead of the usual many weeks and days, because that would hasten the process. So over the last 2 days and late into the night, the parties were working towards a deal, and finally a return to work formula was signed this afternoon, and this was taken to court, and the strike was called off with a return to work formula, which was signed by both parties.
So when do you hope the doctors will return to work?
No, it's immediate. So once a return to work formula is called and the strike has actually been called off, then from tomorrow, immediately, the doctors return to work.
Dr. Chikundu, the strike was about several issues, including the stipends or payment for intern doctors. Has that been taken care of under this agreement?
Yeah, so in the return to work formula, the government and the doctors' union had different positions. And earlier on, like 2 weeks ago, the doctors' union had actually moved to court. And the court had actually directed that the circular that had proposed the stipend was stayed. It was not legal, so to speak. And there's still a court case on that pending. So in the return to work formula, both positions were put in place, and the return to work formula says that this should be sorted out within the next 60 days, notwithstanding a hearing of the case in court.
Dr. Chigundu, can you reflect? Do you think that a strike was worth it?
So the reason doctors go on strike is to bring the government on table for agreements that they have failed to fulfill, and a strike does not come like immediately, because there had been a conciliation process of the items of the collective bargaining agreements for the last 1 year. So the strike did bring the government to the table, albeit late, and you can see the reason the strike has extended for long is that the government was actually slow to commit to some of the things. So the measurement of what a strike is supposed to achieve is supposed to bring the government to the table and to highlight some of the issues that are considered important to the doctor. So I think the issues have been highlighted, and I think going forward, there will be efforts to avoid such industrial action in future.
Dr. Simon Kigondu is the president of the Kenya Medical Association. He was speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Amnesty International has accused the Somali military of killing 23 civilians, including 14 children and 5 women, during strikes conducted with Turkish drones on March 18 this year. In a new report released this week, the Human Rights Watchdog has called on both the Somali and Turkish governments to investigate these incidents for potential war crimes. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Abdi Ismail Samata, a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament, for his take on the Amnesty report.
I think it's a standard report. Not only the Turks' drones are killing it, the American drones have killed the civilians and so on and so forth. What it just underscores, in my opinion, is the laxity with which these militaries operate in the country, such that civilian lives are not valued at all. And so I think Amnesty International should be commended, not only for pointing out at this, but also for pointing out at other militaries, the African Union forces and others who have killed Somalis, who are sort of ordinary, sort of peace-loving people. And so the focus should not be on the Turks per se, but the way in which the entire war is conducted in this country against Al-Shabaab.
Amnesty International calls on the Somali and Turkish governments to investigate those incidents for what they call potential war crimes. How realistic for the two governments to investigate themselves?
I don't think the Somali government has any capacity, for that matter, to be able to investigate such a thing. So it's a sort of a laudable sort of a proposition that Amnesty is making it. But there has to be an international unit in the country, since the African Union, the American government, the Europeans, and everybody seems to have a stake in this country and the war against Al-Shabaab. There should be an independent standing unit that deals with these matters, rather than sort of pointing the finger at the Somali government, who doesn't have the capacity to do any of these things, nor anybody else for that matter.
What do you make of those some analysts who claim that too many foreign participation or too many participants in the Somali conflict are making matters worse?
I have always argued, as a scholar who have studied this country for the last 30 years, that the amount of resources that has been spent on these various military agendas, if a small proportion, 25% of that, has been invested in developing a
Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The Somali government has rejected Amnesty International's report. In a text message to VOA, Abdi Rahman Yusuf Al-Adalad, the Deputy Minister of Information of Somalia, said, quote, "To date, we have received no reports indicating any harm inflicted on civilians by the military operations." Chad's opposition, the Transformers Party, says its candidate and Prime Minister Success Masra and his supporters have been threatened with violence. The French news agency AFP reports that the party said in its Facebook page that Masra was under surveillance and faces threats to his safety. Masra is the main challenger to interim president Mohamed Idriss Deby in the May 6 election. Ndulubai Jaseda is the Transformers vice president for political affairs and the diaspora. He tells me that Chadians voted for change on Monday, but there was some violence against supporters of his party.
The election was well attended. I believe the people of Chad, they wanted a change. So most of them came out, if not all of them came out to vote for a change. So the attendance was very well to my understanding and to what I've seen, because I have driven almost all day long throughout the city of Jalena and received some calls from different provinces. And it showed that Chadian people are ready for a new change.
Help us understand, there is an article that says that the Prime Minister, Masra, is condemning what he called violence and threats against him and his supporters. What do you know about that?
Yes, I'm totally in support of the article, because we had a press conference denouncing some of the traction and violence that were against our militant and our observers. Besides that, there was a drone sent over the residence of the Prime Minister and filming and recording what's happening in his front yard, which is a violation of his privacy. And those videos were published by two ministers of the current government that are not part of our political party, but regardless, it's unacceptable. So that's the reason why that press conference this morning was necessary to let everybody know that we need peace and we need everybody to contribute to the peace process through this election. But there is no need to violate somebody's private life.
Is it true that your party is also alleging that the process, the electoral process, was fraudulent?
Well, I cannot say anything about that right now. We have faith in the election agency, as their mandate is they are nominated for more than running period of a president, meaning that they will be there for the next 7 years. But the term is 5. So we believe that by having such terms will give them the freedom of being transparent in the process along the way. So for this reason, we hope and believe that they will act according to the rules and by following the choice of the people of Chad. We cannot say anything at this moment about anything, but we believe that everything had happened.
So before I let you go, on election day, would you say that your supporters had access to the ballot?
Most of the voting sites went well. In some sites, some of our militants did not have access, but regardless of that, we believe that everything went well because the citizens of Chad, they became the watcher of their own ballots because they, as I said, they are thirsty for change.
Dulemba Jasada is a vice president for political affairs and the diaspora of Chad's opposition, the Transformers Party. He was speaking with us from Chad's capital, N'Djamena. Of America, I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 9th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. African digital and data authorities are seeking a single digital market where safe data can flow across its borders, which can help overcome barriers to business and trade on the continent. Digital experts called on African countries to Tuesday to create and implement relevant laws protecting people and businesses' data, leading to digital transformation across the continent. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
African government information and communications technology representatives, international organizations, diplomats and experts are meeting in Nairobi this week to discuss how data can move freely from one country to another without risking people's privacy and safety. Kenya's Information, Communication and Digital Economy Minister Elwood Owalo said Africa needs to improve its laws to deal with emerging issues in the digital space.
What will enable African countries to remain relevant in the digital marketplace will be our level of creativity and innovation, strategic agility and maneuverability in the digital space. And that means we need to continuously, based on what is happening in our operational environment, look at our laws, policies and regulations. Think of what we need to do.
The 2023 Launda Report, an organization that monitors digital rights, environment and inclusion in Africa, said internet shutdowns and disruptions, data protection, disinformation, cybersecurity, surveillance and a lack of freedom of expression and information impact the continent's digital growth and sustenance. Experts say data plays an important role in every sector and sharing it makes information more accessible, increase collaborations and facilitate knowledge exchange, leading to innovation and growth in business and relations among states. Paul Russo is the head of Kenya Commercial Bank Group, which operates in 7 African countries. He says the discussion about data sharing and security is important for businesses that operate in different African countries.
This is not only a new area that we need to work together to bring to life, but I also think it's important for our own businesses to be sustainable. At the heart of every business, for particularly those of us in the private sector, is data, both integrity and confidentiality and protection of that data.
Data misuse and abuse have worried many people, businesses and governments worldwide, and the fears continue to spark debate on how best to safeguard, regulate, monitor and benefit from the available data. European Union Deputy Head of Mission to Kenya, Andre Simek, said data protection requires global effort and that gaps must be filled with legal means.
Collaboration between data protection authorities around the world is needed to advance the regional and global harmonization of legal and regulatory frameworks. One area of specific importance is that of safe cross-border data flows. A first step is ensuring the data protection laws are in place. The second one is obviously to operationalize them effectively. These are critical steps towards Africa's single digital market and towards a global area for safe data exchange.
While internet accessibility is growing on the continent and some are willing to exchange data, some are hesitant to do so over the lack of regional legal framework to guide data sharing without breaking national laws. African digital and data experts hope to overcome the policies and laws that hinder information sharing. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Israeli authorities have deported 12 Malawian laborers for breaching contracts by abandoning their lawful employment at farms to work at a bakery. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The deportation comes weeks after Malawi and Israel signed a memorandum of understanding on a new labor export deal to help address challenges workers were facing under the previous arrangement, which was championed by agents. However, in a statement issued Tuesday evening, Malawi government spokesperson Moses Kunkuyu said the Malawi embassy in Tel Aviv noted that the deported workers had valid visas and contracts to work in specific farms in the Israeli agriculture sector. But he says the problem was that they abandoned their lawful employment at the farms to start working at the bakery. Kunkuyu says it is an offense under Israeli law for a foreign worker holding a specific visa or work permit to change jobs without following necessary procedures. He cautioned those who choose to go to work in Israel that a breach of contract will not be tolerated. Malawi started exporting labor to Israel in November, aimed at boosting Malawi's foreign exchange reserves. Records show that over 1,000 Malawian workers are currently employed on Israeli farms. Currently, Malawi is expected to send about 3,000 unskilled laborers to work on various agriculture farms. Luther Mambala is the former president of the Malawi Congress of Trade Unions. He told VOA that it is surprising that some individuals would run away from their designated workplaces in Israel.
To me as a labor activist, that cannot be a surprise because I know how sweet it is to work in a foreign land. Definitely, you're getting your money in dollars. With this devaluation of the kwacha, it means you are getting more money. So you can't just run away, definitely.
Malawi recently devalued its local currency by 44%, which resulted in price hikes of commodities and services. However, VOA could not find an opportunity to speak with four deported laborers who arrived in the country Tuesday. But a Malawi delegation, which recently visited workers in Israel, told a press conference in April that some workers told them that they were working under a conducive environment and conditions. Adam Chikapagais is an economist based in Blantyre. He told VOA that the news of their deportation is embarrassing and suggests that it's time for the Malawi government to think of creating jobs for its people.
And we have to do a lot more things that are there for job creation. For example, the issue of mining. You know, if the government could have intensified the issue of the mining in this country, believe you me, the issue of the job creation, wealth creation, and food security could have been the issue of the past.
However, Kunkuyu says 80 other workers were expected to arrive in Malawi Wednesday. In the meantime, the Malawi government is calling upon all migrant workers in Israel to desist from quote-unquote such behavior, saying it puts the country into disrepute. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blantyre.
Limited medical resources in Africa force some patients to travel abroad for specialized surgeries. Now, a new specialty surgery institute has opened in Ghana to try and help. Sinanu Todd reports from Accra.
In Accra, medical experts from the U.S. are performing a special cancer removal surgery for a kidney patient. The procedure is minimally invasive and uses cameras and robots, and until recently was unavailable in this part of the world. Dr. Harriet Akunonunu.
Someone could have been done here. They already referred the guy outside. So he already had his visa and everything. And then someone told him about this place.
This place is the West African Institute for Special Surgery, or WISE. It opened in March to cater to specialty surgery needs in West Africa and beyond. Dr. Kofi Buahene is a surgeon at the institute.
Plastic surgery, for example, there is just general plastic surgery, trying to get wounds and broken bones to heal. But at the level that we are providing care, we do micro transplant of tissues. You lose a finger, we put it back, make an ear, make a nose, make a face.
Dr. Kofi Buahene, a native of Ghana, is a head and neck surgeon, facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital in the U.S. In 2004, he set up his Foundation for Special Surgery, or FSS, to provide specialized medical care to people where they live.
People from all over the world will come and see me in the U.S. I'm able to, 2 hours, change their lives. I take a plane. It takes 9 hours, 10 hours to fly to Ghana. Same clinical situation. That person may lose their eyesight or may lose their life.
For this reason, Dr. Buahene and the FSS built the West African Institute for Special Surgery. He says the center will bring globally trained health professionals to Ghana.
In neurosurgery, in plastic surgery, in head and neck surgery, in ear surgery, in urology, the highest level of specialists are all congregating here.
Medical professionals from Ghana and across Africa can train and practice with these global experts and equipment. Again, Dr. Harriet Akunonunu.
Here I get to see robotic surgery. Yes, it's going to be the first in the country. So I get to see that. And that's awesome. That's pretty cool, you know, using robots to, you know, fix things. So yeah.
Dr. Buahene says the institute will bill patients who ordinarily would have traveled overseas. However, for patients who cannot afford care, the institute will raise money from friends, family, donors, and former patients abroad, just as they have done for his Foundation for Special Surgery. Sena Anutot, VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Can immigrants vote in U.S. elections? The answer is not until they become naturalized citizens. Naturalization is a lengthy process that begins with obtaining a green card, also known as a permanent resident card. VOA's Arlene Barrows explains the process.
Immigrants who are not U.S. citizens cannot vote in federal elections. Those who become naturalized citizens can vote in any U.S. election after they take the Oath of Allegiance and register to vote. The first step toward naturalization is to obtain a green card, conferring legal permanent residency. A person can get a green card through family sponsorship, employment, and refugee or asylum status, among others. In most cases, immigrants are eligible for naturalization after they've been green card holders and have lived in the U.S. for 5 years. This is reduced to 3 years if they acquire permanent residency through marriage to a U.S. citizen. Steps to becoming a U.S. citizen include meeting eligibility requirements, submitting an application for naturalization, passing an interview and English and civics exams, and taking the Oath of Allegiance at a naturalization ceremony. Generally, there are exceptions and special provisions for certain groups, such as military personnel, spouses of U.S. citizens stationed abroad, and children of U.S. citizens. Spouses of U.S. citizens who are stationed abroad because of their employment with the U.S. government, including military service, may be eligible for naturalization under a provision that allows them to bypass the residency requirement and apply for naturalization while residing outside the United States. Once naturalized, individuals have the right to vote in all federal, state, and local elections, including presidential elections. Non-citizens, including green card holders, are prohibited from voting in federal, state, and most local U.S. elections. Anyone caught voting illegally faces fines and/or imprisonment and possible removal from the United States.
And that's it for this Thursday, May 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty Washington saying, have a great day and please be safe whatever you do.